about to present was what persuaded him that Christianity was true. This teaser had me at the edge of my seat, because I was right there with him, at that very phase in my life. He continued his opening statement by emphasizing the importance of the resurrection. The reason Jesus' resurrection is so important is because the truth of Christianity hinges on this event. Jesus' atoning death and resurrection have been bedrock doctrines of Christianity since its inception. Therefore, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, the foundation collapses and Christianity is false. On the other hand, if Jesus did rise from the dead, then there is good reason to believe Christianity is true. That's why this evening's debate is much, much more than an academic discussion. The eternal destiny of our souls may very well hinge on what we do with Jesus and his resurrection. I thought to myself, "You're right, Mike. Christianity hinges on the resurrection, and there are souls in the balance. Your case better be compelling." Two things were undeniable about Mike's argument. It was historically grounded, and it was concise. He laid out his argument clearly. Tonight, I want to present three facts for you that are strongly evidenced and granted by a large majority of scholars. Combined, the best explanation for these three facts is that Jesus rose from the dead. Fact number one, Jesus' death by crucifixion. That Jesus was crucified and died through the process is granted by virtually 100% of scholars who study the subject. As he would do after stating each fact, Mike provided evidence. For the fact that Jesus died by crucifixion, he delved into the arguments that he and Gary had shared with me some 18 months prior, including the excruciating process of flogging and the multiple attestations of Jesus' death by crucifixion. He added that the expert opinion of modern medical professionals was that Jesus must have died, given the historical process of crucifixion. Having argued sufficiently for the first fact, Mike proceeded to the next. Fact number two, the empty tomb. An impressive 75% of scholars who study the subject acknowledge the empty tomb. Mike explained that there were multiple reasons to believe Jesus' tomb was empty a few days after his crucifixion. First, the Christian movement was founded on the principle that Jesus had been raised and was no longer dead. Christianity began in Jerusalem, and if Jesus' body had still been in the tomb, the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem could easily have ended Christianity by parading Jesus' body throughout the city. That they didn't do it lends weight to the position that the tomb was empty. Another reason to conclude the tomb was empty was the Jewish concept of resurrection. Most Jews believed in a bodily resurrection, that the very body that died and was buried would be raised on the day of resurrection and transformed into an immortal body. It would seem that if the disciples were proclaiming Jesus' resurrection, they envisioned his very body having been raised, and that implies the empty tomb. The final reason has to do with the position of the Jewish leadership. When asked about Jesus, they said that the disciples had stolen the body, implicitly agreeing that the tomb was empty. To sum up this point, Mike quoted William Wand, a former professor from Oxford University. "All the strictly historical evidence we have is in favor of the empty tomb, and those scholars who reject it ought to recognize that they do so on some other ground than that of scientific history." That brought Mike to his final piece of evidence. Fact number three, testimony to the resurrection of Jesus. On a number of occasions, we see that the disciples of Jesus believed that he had been resurrected and appeared to them. Not only the disciples testified to this, but foes of Jesus as well. Mike referenced multiple early sources to defend this point. He argued that the early church was built on the teaching that Jesus was risen, and the fact that the disciples were willing to die for their belief that Jesus rose from the dead. In fact, not only were the disciples willing to die for this belief, but so were a couple of people who had been opposed to Jesus' message during his life, namely Paul and James. This point seemed problematic to me. So what if people were willing to die for their belief that Jesus appeared? That doesn't mean he did. But Mike anticipated this and clarified that, at the very least, it meant they truly believed he had appeared to them, and they weren't lying about their beliefs. His point was pithy. Liars make poor martyrs. Finally, after presenting the three facts, Mike made his argument. Let's go ahead and build a case now based on those three facts. We've seen that these facts are strongly evidenced historically, and that they're granted by an impressive majority of scholars, if not virtually every scholar who studies this subject, including skeptical ones. We can see Jesus' resurrection easily explains all of these facts without any strain. In the absence of any plausible alternate theories to account for these facts, Jesus' resurrection can be accepted with confidence as the event that occurred. In other words, Mike was arguing that Jesus' resurrection was the best explanation of the known facts, and other theories required investigators to strain, twist, or ignore the facts. I leaned back in my seat and considered the argument. There seemed to be something wrong about this. Could it be so simple? I considered alternative explanations. What if the people who thought they saw the risen Jesus had just hallucinated? Well, the tomb wouldn't be empty, would it? Plus, how likely is it that so many people would hallucinate the same thing on multiple occasions? Mike quoted 1 Corinthians chapter 15 during the debate, which said 500 people saw Jesus risen at the same time. Was there such a thing as mass hallucinations? Plus, that still doesn't explain why enemies of Jesus like Paul would have seen the risen Jesus. He would have had no reason to hallucinate Jesus' return. Well, what if it wasn't Jesus they saw, but someone else? I considered this for a moment, but it also didn't work. As before, the tomb would not be empty. Plus, was it really possible that the disciples would confuse someone else with Jesus? They had been with Jesus for 1,000 days or more. It was not a good explanation. What if Jesus didn't die on the cross? That was the Amity position, and Mike and Gary had refuted all those arguments. But when Shabir began his opening statement, it was clear he was going to argue that position. A surge of excitement overcame me. Would this celebrated champion vindicate our position after all? Shabir began speaking, and it was immediately obvious that he was quite comfortable on stage and well acquainted with the information. The fact that I am a Muslim may be a bias that precludes me from appreciating the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. I want to first acknowledge that, then put it aside and look clearly at the facts. I do not find the evidence for the resurrection persuasive. If someone said to me that a man had died and was then seen alive 3 days later, I would have to ask, "Are you sure he was really dead?" Scholars who have combed the Gospels have asked, "What caused Jesus' death?" Doctors who have read the accounts cannot agree as to what caused his death. If we take just the narratives the way they are in the text, one would not be sure Jesus actually died on the cross. Shabir had much more to say, but this was the heart of his defense. As the debate proceeded, though, it became clear that Shabir had to deny and ignore far more than an objective investigator would. He denied that the usual crucifixion process was meted to Jesus, though he gave no reason why. He denied the validity of John's crucifixion account, even though he admitted that John's account was more true to the historical process of crucifixion. He accepted that non-Muslim scholars universally conclude Jesus died by crucifixion, but he paradoxically denied that the crucifixion played any significant role in their assessment. He ignored clear statements from all the Gospels that Jesus died. On and on and on, he denied and ignored very important bits of data to make his case. As enraptured as we all were by Shabir's oratory and rhetorical prowess, focusing on his arguments led to two conclusions. His skepticism of the data was unwarranted, and he applied nowhere near the same level of skepticism to his own position. This inconsistency had to be the result of his bias, one that I could see even as a Muslim who wanted to agree with him. After the debate, Mike and Shabir went to different rooms to meet with the audience members and answer their questions. I slowly rose from my seat, disappointed in processing what it all meant. I paced around the hall and contemplated the debate for about an hour, until Mike, David, Gary, and I finally headed toward the parking lot together. It was dark and cold, and we could see our breath crystallize in the pale streetlight as we spoke. Mike turned to me and said, "Nabil, I'm really interested to hear what you think. If you could assign 100 points divided between me and Shabir, how would you assign them?" "Well, that depends on what I'm assigning them for," I began. "If we're talking about stage presence and oratorical persuasiveness, I'd have to give Shabir 80 points and you 20. Mike shrugged his shoulders. "Well, thanks for being honest. I did stumble over some of my words and my slides weren't working right, so I can see that. But I guess I'm more interested in the argumentation. What did you think of the overall case?" I thought for a moment. "I think you won in that department, Mike. I'd give you 65 and Shabir 35. Gary gave a shout for joy. "Hey, that's great, Mike. That's a 2-to-1 ratio in favor of the resurrection, from the perspective of a thoughtful Muslim. So, Nabil, you think the argument's pretty good, huh?" Now I shrugged. There's still room for doubt, but objectively speaking, it does seem to be the best explanation. David couldn't resist taking the opportunity to jab me. "So, Nabil, are you a Christian yet?" "In your dreams," I laughed, punching David in the shoulder. "We still haven't looked at whether Jesus claimed to be God, which is the bigger issue to me. Plus, when it comes time to investigate Islam, you'll see how strong arguments can be. It's untouchable. As far as arguments go, the only thing Christianity has over Islam is the resurrection." Gary looked at Mike as if he couldn't believe what he had just heard. "The only thing we've got is the resurrection? Buddy, that's all we need." All four of us discussed the debate in the parking lot for a few more minutes, until the freezing cold overcame our desire for further fellowship. I hugged Gary, not knowing when I'd see him again. Mike invited me to the monthly discussion meetings at his house, and I told him I'd try to come. David walked back with me to my car, and we ended up sitting in it and discussing Christianity and Islam for another 2 hours. When I finally left Regent University for home, I'd clarified some points in my mind. It was clear that they had gotten me with their strongest arguments first, and they certainly were strong. The historical evidence categorically pointed to Jesus' death on the cross. And the best explanation for the events surrounding his death was that Jesus was raised from the dead. But now it was my turn. I was going to put together the best argument to prove that Jesus never claimed to be God. In my heart, I knew that this next issue would be the decisive battle, and I was ready to go to war. Part 5. Jesus, mortal Messiah or divine Son of God? Did you enter into this world? Did you become a man? And was that man Jesus? Chapter 28. Genetics and Jesus. MGB-101 was an amphitheater-style auditorium, the third largest room on a campus of 20,000 students. Immensity notwithstanding, David and I sat as far away as possible from the professor and the other students for one very good reason. We found the professor's manner of speech hilarious and often could not keep from outbursts of laughter. Dr. Osgood was an excellent teacher, so adept at imparting knowledge that neither David nor I needed to study outside of class to ace the material. But he used quirky terminology, and over time, we had been sensitized to his choice of words. A staple of his parlance was the word cartoon, which he used to refer to anything from a graph to a video. That was comedic gold every time, but the coffers were about to overflow. He motioned to the projected image in the front of the room. "Class, your next topic to master is DNA replication. On their paths to inevitable cell death, cells divide hundreds or thousands of times, undergoing a precise process of copying their genetic information through each generation of daughter cells. DNA replication is that process. If the process were not virtually flawless, species survival would be impossible. In order to understand the mechanics of DNA replication, we must revisit the DNA molecule. Here we have a cartoon of DNA." I stifled a snigger by clearing my throat. "I have already noted that DNA is a double helix comprised of two sugar phosphate strands connected to each other by nucleotide bases. Notice now that the carbon to phosphate bonds in each strand of DNA run from 5 prime to 3 prime. This is the basis for the directionality of each strand." Leaning over to me, David commented under his breath, "Directionality? Is direction not noun enough for him that he has to add a suffix?" We burst into giggles. But Dr. Osgood wasn't done yet. "Due to the conformation of the nucleotide bases, each strand runs in opposite directions. Taking the two strands together, DNA has anti-directionality." David and I turned towards each other, eyes wide in stunned disbelief. This was too much fodder for us. It took our brains a moment to confirm that, yes, he really just said anti-directionality. As if Dr. Osgood had lobbed a canister of concentrated laughing gas at us, David and I were overtaken by paroxysms of silent laughter. We shook for minutes, unable to stop. Finally, when other students began shooting deadly looks at us, we were forced to find a way to stop laughing. I bit my cheek as hard as I could. Regaining control of my body before my judgment, I wrote out the word anti-directionality on a sheet of loose-leaf paper and passed it to David. After another fit of laughter, David scribbled something on the paper and handed it back to me. It now read, "Pseudo-antidirectionality." The fits resumed. When I was able, I took my turn and passed the paper back. A few minutes and a couple hundred calories later, we had the word quasi-pseudo-antidirectionality-asnificationism scrawled across the page. We had laughed so hard in our seats that the bolts were coming loose. The class had just begun, but we decided it would be best to leave. Neither of us could pay attention, and we were not gaining any popularity points by sticking around. We quickly slipped out of the class, yet another benefit of sitting in the back. We joked and laughed as we made our way to the forensics room, arriving a full hour before practice. Pausing to catch my breath, I slipped my backpack off my shoulder and sat down at the front of the classroom. David took his normal seat at the back. We were coming off our high, each deciding how best to use this newfound time. I was considering studying the information in the genetics lecture we had just left when a thought struck me. "You know, David, genetics is a major problem for the Christian faith." David looked characteristically amused.
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah, think about it. Why do we have children? In fact, why does any species reproduce?" David said nothing, but waited. By now he had learned that, to really interact with my thoughts, it was best to let me talk it out first. "Reproduction is for survival. It's just like Osgood said, cells are going to die, so they replicate themselves as much as they can first. The problem is obvious. Why does God need a son if he is immortal?" After pausing for dramatic effect, which seemed lost on David, I continued. "Jews understood this, so they never said God begot a son, and Jesus was a Jew. It must have been after Jesus that Roman culture mixed with the early church. Romans have plenty of stories of gods impregnating women, producing godmen." David asked a clarifying question. "Is that what you think Christians teach?"
"Isn't it?
You say that the Holy Spirit visited Mary, making her pregnant. It would only be logical for the Christian Jesus to be a demigod, since he was born of a human and a god. But let's face it, the Bible describes a fully human Jesus. That explains his hunger, his thirst, his bleeding, his ignorance, and his death." Although I was assembling my arguments on the fly, these thoughts were hardly new, nor even my own. 2 decades of Islamic teaching, daily bolstered by the repetition of the Quran's words, "God begets not, nor is he begotten," were combining with a critical intellect and an ardent desire to advance the faith of my fathers. My battle against the lordship of Jesus was an organic outgrowth of everything that defined me. It was here I would make my stand, and I was not backing down without a fight. But whether by preoccupation, a stroke of intuition, a leading of the Holy Spirit, or unfamiliarity with the subject, David didn't fight back. "Nabil, have you read any books by Christians on the deity of Jesus?"
"No, but I've talked to a bunch of Christians about it."
"Well, let's do this. I'll give you a book tomorrow, and you read it when you get a chance. Then we'll talk." I was taken aback. David rarely turned down a tussle. "Why not talk now?" "Because I need to study the stuff we missed in genetics." "And whose fault is that, David?" "As much yours as anyone else's, buddy. Hey, you were the one who started the whole suffix business." And so we bickered our way through the hour, neither studying genetics nor arguing theology. It was all for the best, though. My Islamic identity was so strongly forged as a reaction against the deity of Jesus that a discussion at this point invariably would have been counterproductive and divisive. What was needed first was a small inroad, a route past the Islamic knee-jerk reaction against Jesus' deity. The book David planned to give me would get me asking the right questions and start me on that path. It proved to offer significant headway, especially considering how small it was. Chapter 29. Jesus Creates Carpenters. I looked down at the book David slid across the table toward me. The lunchtime din of the student union forced me to focus extra carefully, taken aback as I was by the book's title and compact size. Furrowing my brow, I rifled through its pages before sending it back across the table. "I already know Jesus is more than a carpenter." David was in an exceptionally playful mood. Fridays had a way of doing that. "Yeah, but he's way more than a carpenter. He actually creates carpenters." I smiled. "I know that's what you say, but that's not what the Bible says." "Yes, it does. The Bible says that all carpenters were made through Jesus." "Come on, David, I'm serious." I faked a frown for emphasis.
David's smile only grew.
So am I. What do you think it means when the Bible says, all things came into being through Jesus?
It says that?
The frown wasn't fake anymore.
Yep.
Not in the Gospels, though. I need to see it in the Gospels.
Last I checked the... He inserted an egregiously fake cough before loudly exclaiming, Gospel of John,
he coughed again, is a gospel.
That's in John?
Yep, he smiled, feigning innocence.
This ran counter to everything Muslim teachers taught about Jesus in the Bible.
Was it possible that a gospel actually said Jesus was the creator?
Why hadn't I heard this before? None of the Christians I had spoken with had mentioned this, and I had challenged so many.
Come to think of it, had anyone other than David told me this, I would not have believed him, assuming instead that he was fabricating things. But I knew David well, and he would not go that route with me.
Maybe David was distorting something?
I didn't know, but I was intrigued.
David saw my gears turning and slid the book back towards me, but this time, dramatically, in slow motion. When I reached out to take it, he quickly pulled it back.
But you already know Jesus is more than a carpenter, he said, still smiling.
I leaned forward and snatched the book away from David.
Quit gloating.
Later that weekend, I flopped onto the ground in Abba's study, examining the book more carefully. More Than a Carpenter was very compact, the size of my hand, and only about 100 pages. The author's name was Josh McDowell, and I had seen his name before. Abba owned a book called The Islam Debate, a transcript of a 1981 dialogue between McDowell and celebrated Muslim apologist Ahmed Didat. I had not yet read it because it was a full-size monograph and seemingly dealt with defending Islam. I was more concerned with defeating Christianity. But here was a book on Christianity by Josh McDowell, a booklet really, so small it was begging me to read it. I dived in, checking all McDowell's Bible references for accuracy. It is hard to believe, but despite having dozens of Bible verses memorized for the sake of refuting Christianity, this was my first time actually opening a Bible. All the Bible verses I had read before were in Muslim books. I devoured McDowell's book in a matter of hours. Most of it encouraged people to take Jesus and their faith seriously, but I already did that. The chapter that affected me most was chapter 2, What Makes Jesus So Different? Here, McDowell defended the claim that the New Testament presents Jesus as God. When I finished the book, I decided to revisit that chapter with a more critical eye. I found many of McDowell's arguments insufficient. There were alternate explanations he was not considering. For example, he quoted Matthew 16:16, where Peter exclaims that Jesus is the Son of the living God, in order to show that Jesus is divine. But I had been taught a counterargument early in childhood. Many people are called sons of God in the Bible, such as Adam, Solomon, even unnamed strangers. The Bible actually teaches that we can become sons of God, even going so far as to say that humans are gods. Elsewhere, McDowell quoted Matthew and Luke to argue that Jesus had characteristics of God, like omnipotence, but none of his references were convincing for me. They all showed Jesus doing miracles, to be sure, but the Muslim explanation for Jesus' miracles was simple. They were all done by God's permission, not by any power intrinsic to Jesus. This is what the Quran said, and I had long before memorized Bible verses that showed Jesus' works were actually from the Father, and that he could do nothing without God. As a Muslim trained to counter Christianity, I found nothing new in most of McDowell's statements, and I had long been adept at turning these arguments back at Christians. But McDowell did succeed in convincing me that even if there were verses in John's Gospel that I could use to refute the deity of Jesus, there were others that painted Jesus in an undeniably divine light. For example, Jesus said, "All will honor the Son just as they honor the Father." In addition, a disciple addressed Jesus as God, only to be praised by Jesus. I had not heard these quotations before, and they did not fit into my mindset. They could not. There was no way Jesus would say or allow these things, at least not the Jesus I knew. I began processing these new verses, struggling to harmonize them with the contrasting verses I had memorized as a child. I paced across the study, wondering, how does it all fit together? I know there are verses in the Quran that apparently contradict one another, but Abba or an imam can usually resolve them for me. Is there anyone in the Jamaat who knows the Bible as they know the Quran? A thought that had been simmering in my mind since I started reading McDowell's book suddenly came to a whistling boil. Like a man finally stepping back for the first time after inspecting a mosaic piece by piece, I realized I had missed the big picture. The Bible and the Quran were nothing alike. Not in the slightest. Why was I trying to interpret them the same way? Muhammad dictated the contents of the Quran to his scribes over a period of 23 years. Only after his death was the Quran collected into a book. Verses that had been dictated years or decades apart are frequently found side by side in the Quran, often with no obvious connection. The result is that Muslims place relatively little weight on surrounding passages when trying to interpret sections of the Quran. For context, they turn instead to historical commentaries, hadith called Asbab al-Nazul. So fractured are narratives in the Quran that only one story has a clear beginning, middle, and end, the story of Joseph. All the other stories pick up in the middle, or else they are never carried to their conclusions. It was no wonder I had to turn to my teachers in order to understand the Quran. But as I read through the Bible in conjunction with McDowell's book, I realized that the Gospels were coherent narratives, each serving as its own context. There was no need for any commentary in order to understand the Gospels. Anyone can understand the Bible. Conversely, I could not just focus on individual verses to make a point about a Gospel, as we often did with the Quran. I needed to read the whole Gospel, understand the author's intent and themes, and let the book speak for itself. Armed with this new perspective, I decided to read the Gospel of John from the beginning, before trying to interpret it. I sat back down on the ground and opened Abba's Bible to John chapter 1. What I found did not sit well with me. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. There it was, full stop. I pored over these verses, reading them and rereading them. There was no other explanation. The verses were saying that God created the world by means of the Word, that the Word was co-eternal with God, and that it was God Himself, yet in some sense separate from Him. It was obvious that the Word was Jesus, not just because John's Gospel was ostensibly about Jesus, but also because the Quran calls Jesus the Word of God. Besides, verse 14 left little doubt, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw His glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father." It had to be Jesus. Incredulous, I put the Bible down and began pacing the room once more, assembling the pieces in my mind. This was John's first chapter, his prologue. Like an introduction in modern books, it gives us the lens through which to read the rest of the book. It was as if John were saying, as you read this Gospel, keep in mind that Jesus is co-eternal with the Father, His partner in creating the world. Here was the context I needed to resolve the tension in other parts of the Gospel. Whatever difficulty I might have while reconciling verses, I had to keep John's prologue in mind. Jesus is God. As the inevitability grew in my mind, I stopped pacing and stared at the Bible, still open to John chapter 1. I could not believe it. It simply could not be true. Jesus could not be God. There must be some other explanation, or else I was deceived. There must be some other explanation, or else my family and everyone I loved was caught in a lie. If Jesus truly did claim to be God, then the Quran is wrong and Islam is a false religion. There must be some other explanation. I did not yet know what that explanation was, but it had to be there. I had faith that it was there, and I did not doubt that Allah would show it to me. I immediately went to our living room, where we offered our congregational prayers. I approached the prayer rug, raised my hands to my ears, recited Allahu Akbar, and offered Allah 2 rakats of nafl prayer. I was ready to recommit myself to this battle, and I was invoking the help of Allah. Chapter 30. The Divine Son of Man. John doesn't count. I figured you'd say that. We were back in Webb Center, the same table where David had given me More Than a Carpenter. I had spent the weekend studying John's Gospel on the internet and praying avidly. It was not that I was worried. Simply taking sides on these issues meant repeatedly reasserting my commitment to Islam, and I was becoming more and more devout because of it. Plus, I was convinced that Allah was rewarding my faith with answered prayers and arming me to fight against David's position. I discovered mounds of arguments against the accuracy of John's Gospel. Having spent the past few days regrouping, I was prepared to redraw battle lines. Now, I was bringing out the big guns. "So why doesn't it count?" David asked. "It was the last gospel, written 70 years after Jesus. It looks nothing like the other gospels, which appeared much earlier." "But we went over this, Nabil. John's gospel was written by a disciple, or at least in the lifetime of disciples. What it says is trustworthy." "I wouldn't be so sure, David. 70 years after Jesus is a decent amount of time. We can't be sure that the disciples were still around that late." "But there's a bigger issue here. Why does it look so different from the other Gospels? Jesus doesn't use a single parable in John, and he talks about himself a lot more frequently than in the Synoptics. Plus, there's only one miracle that's actually common to all four Gospels. John seems to be telling us about his Jesus, a later Jesus, a different Jesus." "Where did you get this?" David's tone betrayed a hint of fluster. "That was truly rare, and I relished the vindication. I wasn't just fighting for my pride, after all. I was fighting for my family and my faith." "A new search engine I found. Google." "No, no. I meant, who are you quoting?" David pressed. His curiosity piqued. "Doesn't sound like a Muslim." "It was a Christian scholar Shabir quoted in a debate. Bart Ehrman." A look of understanding crossed David's face. "Bart Ehrman is not a Christian." "Oh, I thought he was," I smiled, savoring the moment. "He went to seminary." "Yeah, but he later left the faith." "Well, I can see why," I responded, half-jokingly, but only half. "Okay, back to Jesus' deity. Did you find nothing in McDowell's book that was convincing?" "Not outside John's gospel." I was not about to let John off the hook that quickly. "All right, how about this? I'll look into John and get back to you. In the meantime, I'll give you another book, and you let me know what you think." "Sounds good. But you've got to do better than more than a carpenter, David. Maybe pick something bigger next time." David laughed. "You asked for it." A couple days later, I was back on the floor of Abba's study, staring at a golden tome. It was called The New Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And though this book was also written by McDowell, it was in an entirely different class. It was 800 pages of lecture notes that McDowell had collected over his years researching Christian origins. I was undaunted. My recent victory over David's argument from John's Gospel had given me a newfound confidence. I was more certain than ever that Allah was on my side, that no arguments against him would prevail, and that the deity of Jesus was an innovation relegated to later Christianity. If Jesus truly claimed to be God, we could expect his claim to be found in the earliest Gospel, not just the last one. I needed to see Jesus' claim to deity found in the Gospel of Mark. Without hesitation, I opened straight to the chapter on Jesus' deity and got started. As if McDowell had presciently read my mind, the very first piece of evidence that he offered was Jesus' own legal testimony concerning himself in Mark's Gospel. When the high priest asked if he was the Christ, the Son of God, Jesus testified to the Sanhedrin, "I am, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Apart from the "I am," I did not find the statement very clear, and I could not immediately see why McDowell would have chosen it as his primary argument. What did Jesus mean by this? Whatever he meant, one thing was clear. The priests of the Sanhedrin thought he made a statement about his identity that they considered blasphemous, warranting execution. There was only one identity claim that deserved such a harsh penalty, claiming to be God. Claiming to be the Messiah was not enough. But what exactly did Jesus say in his reply to the Sanhedrin that made them think he was claiming to be God? McDowell quoted a New Testament scholar, Craig Blomberg, who explained, "This reply combines allusions to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, and Psalm 110, verse 1. In this context, Son of Man means far more than a simple human being. Jesus is describing himself as the one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, who approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence, and given authority and power over all humanity, leading to universal worship and everlasting dominion. This claim to be far more than a mere mortal is probably what elicited the verdict of blasphemy from the Jewish High Court. I was perplexed. Was Blomberg saying that the title Son of Man was a claim to be God? That was impossible. I thought back to a chutzpah I had heard at a mosque in Washington, D.C., where the imam stood at the head of the prayer hall, proclaiming, "Jesus repeatedly denied being God. He always called himself the Son of Man to drive the point home. He is a human. He never calls himself the Son of God. That is why we know the few times he is called a Son of God by others, it does not mean he is a literal Son of God. Jesus is the Son of Man. He is human." Could it be that the term Son of Man actually meant something more? I had to read Daniel chapter 7 for myself. I grabbed Abba's Bible off the shelf, looked up Daniel in the table of contents, and flipped to Daniel chapter 7. There indeed, just as Blomberg had said, was a prophetic vision of one like a Son of Man who was worshipped for all eternity by men of every language. This Son of Man was given authority and sovereign power over an everlasting kingdom. My mind raced. What could this mean? I recalled that Blomberg said Jesus' response also referred to Psalm 110. Perhaps that could clarify things for me? I looked up Psalm 110 and read the first verse. "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet." But what did that mean? How does the Lord say something to the Lord? Who is God inviting to sit at his right hand? I took my search online and began looking up as much information as I could about Daniel chapter 7 and Psalm 110. After a few hours, it was clear. Daniel chapter 7 spoke of a Son of Man that shared sovereignty in heaven with God, being worshipped by all men with the reverence due only to God. Psalm 110 spoke of another Lord, someone who would sit on God's throne alongside God and serve as his heir. In Mark chapter 14, verse 62, Jesus claimed to be the divine Son of Man and the sovereign heir of the Father's throne. He was boldly claiming to be God. But how could this be? Perhaps this portion of Mark, like the Gospel of John, did not accurately reflect what Jesus claimed. I fervently searched the internet for a way out, but there was none. Jesus called himself the Son of Man more than 80 times in the four Gospels. That he really used the term was undeniable. His position as the one sitting at the right hand of the power was deeply embedded in church doctrine, even at the earliest layer. If these were divine claims, Jesus' deity was laced throughout the Gospels and earliest church history. At nightfall, I reluctantly turned off the computer, put McDowell's book away, and just let this new information simmer. I was at an impasse. I could not get myself to admit that the earliest gospel, and in fact, every gospel thereafter, was built around the framework of Jesus' deity. But neither could I deny it. On the one hand, the cost was too high, and on the other, the evidence was too strong. Mercifully, and despite the title of the book, the evidence did not demand a verdict, at least not right away. I did not need to consciously address the incongruity between the evidence and my beliefs. Subconsciously, though, the tension and pressure found an outlet in my life, by way of a renewed fervor for Islam. I gained a new zeal for Salat, spent more time studying Hadith, and employed Islamic terms more frequently in daily speech. I did whatever it took to avoid the evidence, but I could not escape it forever. And months later, when the tension finally resurfaced, it put my relationship with David to the test. Chapter 31. Polemics in the Earliest Jesus. Rain thundered on the roof of my car. What had been a gentle morning shower a moment before was now a deluge, obscuring the afternoon sun. It was a new semester, which meant renewed battles with the registrar in the financial aid department. The administrative offices were in Rowlands Hall, at the other end of campus, and David had to make the trek. I offered to drive him so he could avoid getting wet, but the rain had since become so fierce that even exiting the car was sure to ruin whatever books and electronics he might have had in his backpack. So we sat in my car,
waiting for a break in the storm. Why we picked that moment to talk about the tensest matter between us, I will never know. The storm outside the car was nothing compared to the one brewing inside it. "So I looked into John's gospel," David started. "Oh? What did you find?" Even though my problem with John's gospel was moot since I had found a high Christology in the synoptics, I had never admitted this to David. "First, you're right that John looks different from the other gospels, but that's just because it comes from a different disciple who had his own perspective. Just like two people telling the same story, they'll tell it differently, but that doesn't mean one of them is wrong." I decided to engage him, though my heart was not in it. "But John is more than just a little different from the synoptics." "Yes, but not so different that it's incompatible." David waited for me to respond, but I had nothing to say, so he continued. "Second, we can't be too sure John was written around 90 to 100 AD. "Why's that?" "The way scholars date John's gospel is somewhat arbitrary. Many of them date it that late because of what it teaches about Jesus. They assume that a high Christology means a later date." "Doesn't it?" I pushed. "Christians hadn't developed a high Christology by the time the synoptics were written." "I think the Christology in the synoptics is pretty high, but for the sake of argument, let's just say it isn't. You still have a problem. There are writings from before the Gospels that prove Christians saw Jesus as God." David was taking the conversation in a different direction, and he piqued my curiosity. "What writings?" "The letters of Paul." By saying this, David had unknowingly lit a short fuse on a hidden powder keg. Muslims are often trained to despise Paul, to see him as the hijacker of early Christianity. From the highest imam in our Jamaat all the way down to my father and mother, I had been repeatedly taught that Paul had corrupted Jesus' message, misleading billions into worshiping the mortal Messiah. Because of what the Quran and Hadith teach, Muslims must revere Jesus and the disciples. They were people chosen by Allah to spread his true message, including the fact that Jesus was just a human. But somewhere very early in Christian history, people began to worship Jesus. That was anathema and blasphemy. Muslims are left with no recourse other than to place the blame on an early, influential Christian outside of the circle of disciples. Paul is that Christian. Oblivious, David continued. "The writings of Paul make it clear that Jesus was God to the earliest Christians. Paul started writing in the 40s, a decade or so before Mark was written. For example, one of his earliest letters says that Jesus existed in the form of God, and that he emptied himself to become human. In another of his earliest letters, he divides up characteristics of Yahweh among Jesus and the Father." "So what?" I said, somewhat annoyed. "Well, obviously, if the community is already proclaiming that Jesus is God himself in human flesh, then we can expect a gospel written by that community to contain that belief. We should read the Gospels through the contextual lens of the early Christian beliefs, which we can see through Paul's letters." By this point, I had had enough. I subtly mimicked David in retort. "Well, obviously, it's not in Mark. Paul must have been the one to invent Jesus' deity. He's the one who corrupted the Christian message." David was mystified. "What in the world are you talking about?" I rehashed the arguments against Paul that I had learned in khutbas and religious books. "Jesus told people that he had not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. Then Paul came along and said Jesus abolished the law. Jesus told people to worship my God and your God. Then Paul came along and said Jesus was himself God. Paul took the religion taught by Jesus and turned it into a religion about Jesus." David began reciprocating my agitation. "And why would he invent Jesus' deity? He was a Jew. In fact, he was the top student of Gamaliel, a Jew among Jews. What did he have to gain from inventing the idea that Jesus is God?" "Isn't it obvious, David? Paul saw a power vacuum. He saw that Jesus was gone, and that the disciples were too disorganized to take the reins. He wanted power and authority, and so he fashioned himself a disciple, even though he never so much as met Jesus, and then he took control of the burgeoning church, promoting his gospel over other gospels that were being taught, over Jesus' gospel." David laughed incredulously. "Are you serious? Okay, first off, that still does not explain why a devout Jew would turn Jesus into God. He did not need to do that.
even if he was some power-hungry fiend. And second, we know he was not a power-hungry fiend because he was willing to risk his life over and over again for the sake of the gospel. David's voice was getting pressured, his volume rising. All the same, I cut him off. Sometimes people can't pull out of their lies, David. Maybe by that time he was in too deep.
Pull out of his lies? What reason do you have to say Paul is a pathological liar?
I told you he wanted power. David was now beside himself.
Power? If all he wanted was power, he could have just stayed where he was. He was the top student of the top rabbi of his time. Power was coming his way. He went the total opposite direction, choosing a life of meekness and poverty. The early Christians had Paul and his sacrifices to thank for their survival.
Yes, and every Christian will have Paul to thank when they're standing before God, being judged for worshiping a man instead of him. The moment the words escaped my lips, I knew I had gone too far. But it was too late, and I was too proud to apologize. I just stared at David, waiting for his response. David went dead silent. For moments, he did not speak. When he finally did, his words were calm, calculated, and measured, as if each thought was being pressed through layers of filters.
Nabil, after Jesus, I see Paul as the godliest man of all time. I'm not about to just sit here and let you insult him in order to make your theories work.
Our friendship is too important to me, so I think we should avoid talking about this again. He stopped.
Do you agree?
I agree. All right, I'll see you later. With that, David threw open the door and walked out into the storm. Part 6. The Case for the Gospel. But what if His Majesty is not as important to him as his children are? Chapter 32. Tension and the Trinity. Our argument over Paul was not the only time David and I butted heads. Our emotions often got heated as we spoke about our core beliefs. The more important an issue on which we disagreed, the more likely it was that one of us would say something rash. Intense disagreements are bound to lead to intense emotions. But it didn't matter how rough our relationship got. We were living life together. Even if we were at our wits' end, vowing in moments of anger to never deal with one another ever again, we would be forced to smooth things out when we ran into each other in forensics practice later that week, or in class the next day, or, in the case of our argument about Paul, just 20 minutes later, because David needed a ride. This is only one of the reasons why a strong friendship is critical. A surface-level relationship might snap under the tension of disagreement, but by living our lives together, we were forced to reconcile. Of course, beyond mere proximity, we really did love and care for one another. Like true brothers, even after our biggest knock-down, drag-out arguments, we were still brothers. Love covers a multitude of sins. There was a benefit to our arguments, surprisingly. They showed us where points of tension were hiding beneath the surface, needing to be addressed. One such issue that constantly bubbled to the surface was that of the Trinity. As with the doctrine of Jesus' deity, a strong aversion to the Trinity was woven into my Muslim identity and made for a latent landmine. The core doctrine of Islam is Tawheed. A whole field of Islamic theology is dedicated to this topic, so it is difficult to encapsulate, but essentially, Tawheed is the doctrine of God's oneness. This is not merely an affirmation of monotheism, but a thoroughgoing cultivation of the concept of God's absolute unity. God's essence, or the very thing that makes him God, is that he is one, independent, unique, sovereign, set apart, and completely unified. There can be no division within him whatsoever. Distilling this theology in the context of Muslim-Christian dialogue boils down to this. Tawheed, Islam's most fundamental principle, is antithetical to the Trinity. Growing up in an ostensibly Christian nation, my Muslim elders galvanized me against the Trinity. I can recall many Jummah khutbas, classes at youth camps, religious education books, and Quran study sessions dedicated to rebutting the Trinity. They all taught the same thing. The Trinity is thinly veiled polytheism. Roughly, they taught me to see the Trinity like this.
Christians want to worship Jesus in addition to God, but they know that there is only one God. So they say God is at the same time both three and one, calling him a Trinity. Even though this makes no sense, Christians insist it is so. When asked to explain the Trinity, they will say it is a mystery and that it needs to be accepted with faith. When asked to explain the Trinity, they will say it's a mystery and that it needs to be accepted with faith. As a young Muslim in the West, I set out to test this. Whenever I had a discussion about the Trinity with a Christian, the first question I asked was, "Is the Trinity important to you?" When they replied affirmatively, I asked, "How important?" anticipating the response that it would be heretical to deny the Trinity. The third question completed the setup. I would ask, "So what is the Trinity?" and would receive the rote answer that God is three in one. Then came the coup de grace. "And what does that mean?" I usually got blank stares. Sometimes people would start talking about eggs or water. But no one ever was able to explain what the doctrine of the Trinity actually meant. Three what in one what? And how is that not self-contradictory? My questions were not abstruse questions on a peripheral topic. They were simple questions of clarification on essential Christian doctrine, yet no Christian I met growing up was able to answer them. That meant every Christian I encountered bolstered what the Quran had taught me about the Trinity. It was a ridiculous doctrine that merited divine retribution. The elders who taught me to see the Trinity in this light ranged from revered imams to learned leaders to my own parents and grandparents. Everyone I loved and respected taught me to reject the Trinity, and that, combined with the inability of Christians to explain it, makes it easy to see why a repulsion to the Trinity was part and parcel of my Islamic identity. The same is true for almost all practicing Muslims. David and I had a few conversations about the Trinity, and though he answered with more depth and clarity than many other Christians, my mind had been made up well before I met him that the Trinity was unviable. So we butted heads, and as with the issue of Paul, we decided to table the discussion indefinitely. It was coincidence that the solution came to me while I was sitting next to him in the unlikeliest of places. Chapter 33. Resonating with the Trinity. It was July 2003, the summer after my sophomore year, and big life changes were upon me. I had made the decision to graduate from college a year early, which meant I had to begin contemplating the next phase of life. My decision also meant I had to sit for the August administration of the medical college admissions test, an exam that required organic chemistry. So I sacrificed my summer to grueling doses of Ochem 5 days a week. Not surprisingly, David took the class with me, which meant I got grueling doses of David 5 days a week, too. But I was not the only one with big life changes. A while earlier, before boarding a flight to a forensics tournament, David and I had been discussing the resurrection. I made an argument to support the swoon theory, to which David responded, "That weak stuff isn't going to work on me, man. I come from the trailer park. I got common sense." Unbeknownst to us, a new girl on the forensics team had been listening to our debate. She threw her hat into the ring, interjecting, "Oh yeah? Well, I come from single-celled organisms." David and I incredulously turned to her. We barely knew who this girl was, yet she wanted to take us on? One thing David and I agreed on was that blind evolution was statistically impossible. We attacked her arguments together, but she fought back. Over the course of the weekend, we argued with her about truth, relativity, God, evolution, and science. She had spark, and she didn't go down without swinging. 3 days later, Marie was a theist, and David was in love. 2 months after that, the two were engaged. By the summer of 2003, David and Marie had been married a year, and we were all eagerly awaiting the arrival of their first child. David and I sat in Ochem on a hair trigger, ready to pick up the phone and race to the hospital. It was a very exciting time. Despite the need to leave at any moment, and quite despite our incessant note-passing and chuckling, we sat front and center in Mrs. Adamski's lecture hall, not more than 3 feet from her as she taught. I vividly remember the exact location of my seat, because it was there that I first opened up to the Trinity, a moment still etched in my mind. Projected in the front of the room were three large depictions of nitrate in bold black and white. We were studying resonance, the configuration of electrons in certain molecules. The basic concept of resonance is easy enough to understand, even without a background in chemistry. Essentially, the building block of every physical object is an atom, a positively charged nucleus orbited by tiny, negatively charged electrons. Atoms bond to one another by sharing their electrons, forming a molecule. Different arrangements of the electrons in certain molecules are called resonance structures. Some molecules, like water, have no resonance, while others have three resonance structures or more, like the nitrate on the board. Although the concept was easy enough to grasp, the reality proved to be baffling. Mrs. Adamski concluded her lesson by commenting, "These drawings are just the best way to represent resonance structures on paper, but it's actually much more complicated. Technically, a molecule with resonance is every one of its structures at every point in time, yet no single one of its structures at any point in time." The rest of the class must have had the same expressions on their faces that I did, because Mrs. Adamski repeated herself. "It's all the structures all the time, never just one of them." After another brief pause, she afforded us some reassurance. "But don't worry about that. You're only going to be tested on the structures we can draw," to which the class gave a collective sigh of relief. But not me. I turned to David, unable to get past what Mrs. Adamski had just said. David subtly shrugged and returned his attention to the professor as she moved to the next topic. It appeared I was the only one still thinking about the bomb she had just dropped. How could something be many things at once? Many different things? We weren't talking about the attributes of something, like a steak, which can be hot, juicy, thick, and tender all at once. We were talking about separate spatial and electrical arrangements. What the professor said would be akin to saying that Nabil is eating said steak in Texas, while simultaneously napping in a hammock in the Caribbean. As wonderful as each would be individually, it made no sense to say that I might be doing both at once. I was perplexed, and what made it even worse was that no one around me seemed bothered in the least. I looked around the room, agape at their blind acceptance. But was it really blind? The professor was teaching rarefied science, describing the subatomic world. At that level, things happen that make no sense to those of us who conceptualize the world at only a human level. Even the apparently simple idea of atoms is baffling when we think about it. It means that the chair I'm sitting on is not actually a solid object, innocently supporting my weight. It is almost entirely empty space, occupied only in small part by particles moving at incomprehensible speeds. When we think about it, it seems wrong, but it's just the way things are in our universe. There's no use arguing about it. I turn my glance away from the other students, concluding that they had not blindly accepted a nonsensical concept. They had just realized before I did that there are truths about our universe that do not fit easily into our minds. My eyes rested on the three separate structures of nitrate on the wall, my mind assembling the pieces. One molecule of nitrate is all three resonance structures all the time, and never just one of them. The three are separate, but all the same, and they are one. They are three in one. That's when it clicked. If there are things in this world that can be three in one, even incomprehensibly so, then why cannot God? And just like that, the Trinity became potentially true in my mind. I looked over at David and decided to say nothing. Later, I revisited the doctrine of the Trinity with a fresh perspective. What do Christians mean when they say God is three in one? Three what in one what? I looked it up in a book called The Forgotten Trinity by James White, and it all made much more sense after I realized a triune entity was possible. The doctrine of the Trinity teaches that God is three persons in one being. Being and person are not the same thing, which means the Trinity is not a contradiction. To illustrate, consider this. I am one being, a human being. I am also one person, Nabil Qureshi. So I am one being with one person, a human being, who is Nabil Qureshi. The doctrine of the Trinity teaches that God is one being with three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. In the fullness of time, and without any productive discussion with David, I understood the Trinity on my own terms and realized it was a possible model of God's nature.